On the Upper Peninsula, there was some bad news for Berrigo County, Michigan, this past week. The Terex Handlers Company will close its Berrigo plant. 90 people will lose their jobs. Berrigo County, about an hour and a half drive west from Marquette, already has a 24.5% unemployment rate. It's the highest in the state of Michigan and the third highest in the country.
Village office?
No, she's gone for the afternoon.
Okay. Yeah, bye.
Roy Kempinen administers Berrigo Village, a town of 1,300. He's been a village manager in this area for 25 years. Kempinen told us that Berrigo's over 100 years old.
It started out a lot with the logging industry, trapping, that kind of situation. That was basically the way it started out.
You will see some more great scenery and our Ojibwa Casino Resort in Berrigo. It's the first operational Native American casino in Michigan. Don't wait for the fun.
This casino is the county's largest employer. Kempinen is grateful for its presence.
Actually, the village Berrigo's had real good relationship with a local tribe. So I'd say it's been a real plus. They do have casino operations as well as other enterprises that they do a major employment in the county.
So there are people that can go work for the casinos?
Absolutely.
Can that also have a negative effect? I mean, people with little money gambling away what they have?
I guess that is a common thing as far as people, spending funds they don't have available for that recreation, and hopefully it won't become a problem, but I guess that's a problem whether or not you're working or not.
How many jobs would you estimate that the casino provides for people in the Berrigo area?
I think that tribal employment is upwards of 700 people, I think, in the county.
How long have you lived here?
I actually grew up about 3 miles from here, so I've been here my entire life, and I'm into my 50s, put it that way.
Huh. You've never had any desire to leave and go someplace else?
No, not really. Not really. I guess I'm just a country boy at heart, I guess.
What do you think are the future prospects for Berrigo?
Well, I think we are well-positioned. We have a lot of skilled labor here as far as fabrication, those kind of situations. I think the work ethic is really good. You know, if the economy does start turning around, I believe they'll be able to go forward.
And it must be tough knowing that you have the highest unemployment in the state and the third highest unemployment in the country.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It's certainly not something you want to be known for. I guess the only thing I would say is those people are interested in work and certainly are more than capable of doing it, and I hope that they have that opportunity again shortly.
And what would it take? Government help?
You know, it's a situation. I think if the building industry or home building and stuff like that starts to rebound, I think we'll probably see a upturn in the employment in the area because the orders will be coming in for these pieces of machinery. Like I said, signs are that things might be turning around on that situation a little bit. It just seems to take a while to trickle down.
You do seem optimistic, though.
Well, you have to be. When you've been a manager for this many years, you have to have a positive attitude or you got to get out of it, I guess.
Roy Kempinen is the village manager of the village of Berrigo on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
China is going green. China's President Hu Jintao told the UN General Assembly that last week and outlined his country's plan to fight global climate change. While China currently produces more CO2 than any other country in the world, it's also poised to be the next leader in green technology. Wind turbines are being built to replace its coal-powered plants, and plans are underway to introduce the world's first mass-produced all-electric car. Barbara Finnemore is the founder and director of the China Program at the NRDC, the National Resources Defense Council, and she joins us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
China has millions of people who are moving rather quickly into the middle class. And as income rises, energy consumption is bound to rise as well. More and more people are driving cars than in the past. What is China doing to get past that surge?
China is taking steps through policy tools, investment, and subsidies for clean tech, it could become the largest clean tech market in the world. There was a new study that just came out by a group of 80 leading technology companies and entrepreneurs from around the world, and it found that China's clean tech market could be worth as much as $500 billion to $1 trillion a year by 2013.
This shift to new energy technology, it's been likened to something of having the fervor of a new space race toward the next what will be industrial revolution. Is China pulling ahead in this race?
I would not compare the development of a green tech market in China to a space race, because green tech is not an area where one country wins and another loses. It's an area where development of a clean tech market benefits everybody.
President Obama has been criticized by environmentalists for not doing enough with regard to climate change. China was also criticized, but they seem to be acting more quickly than the United States. I just want to bring up a New York Times opinion page piece that was written by Thomas Friedman, and he said, sometimes a one-party autocracy has its advantages. And he was contrasting it to a one-party democracy that we seem to have in the United States at this point. Is China in a position to implement difficult environmental decisions quickly?
To some extent, China is more able than the United States to set ambitious targets for things like renewable energy. But I would say, in the last 8 to 10 years in the United States, there has been a tremendous amount of path-breaking work going on at the state level, particularly in California. And some of the policies that California has put into place, such as its very ambitious solar energy incentives, have become a model for China.
You've been working on this issue in China for, what, 15 years?
I began NRDC's China Clean Energy Program 15 years ago. I remember when I first went to Jiangsu Province, which is California's sister province and one of the most advanced economically in China, nearly 15 years ago, to talk to them about energy efficiency. And nobody there wanted to hear what we had to say. Instead, they said, our goal is to electrify the country. But about 5 years later, when massive blackouts and brownouts swept the country because China could not keep up with its skyrocketing energy demand, these very same people came back to us and said, what were you saying about energy efficiency? Now we'd like to listen.
Barbara Finnemore, director and founder of the National Resources Defense Council's China Program. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Everyone from President Obama on down seems to agree that a good teacher can make a huge difference in a child's life. American schools have been trying for decades to improve teacher quality. The results are mixed. Over the next year, NPR will explore those efforts and will take a look at the latest crop of teachers entering the profession. NPR's education correspondents Claudio Sanchez and Larry Abramson are in the studio to elaborate. Welcome to both of you.
Hi there.
Hello.
Claudio, I want to start with you. Education reformers have been talking about improving teacher quality for years. What's different about what's going on now?
Today, it seems the level of urgency is much higher. Think back to the late 1950s when we were comparing American teachers to that big threat of the Soviet Union and its teachers and how much better they were. We could go to the mid-1960s and the passage of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which made compensatory education, helping poor kids improve in school. And the front and center of that was, of course, improving teaching. And then we go to the mid-1980s, 1983 Nation at Risk, that sounded the alarms as to how mediocre our schools were, in large part because of teaching. 1989, the Summit on Education with the first Bush administration chiming in. And now, in 2001, with the passage of No Child Left Behind, it codified minimum standards for what teachers should have before they went into the classroom. And that included a four-year degree or a BA before they went into teaching, a full state certification before they entered the classroom, and a teacher had to show or demonstrate the subject matter competency, which meant that they needed to understand and know math, science, history before they taught it. This conversation is changing now even more because there is serious money behind it.
Larry Abramson, the Obama administration has boosted education funding pretty substantially. How much is actually going toward programs for teachers?
Well, if you ask the administration, they'll say quite a bit. I mean, there's a program called the Teacher Incentive Fund, which has over $400 million in it. This is actually a Bush administration initiative, which Democrats like to criticize, but now they're trying to rejuvenate it and have actually doubled funding for it. But it's really focused on changing instituting performance pay in a lot of systems. It's not really a ground-up effort to try to change the way teachers are trained. And it's very difficult for the administration to do that because that is really a state function. It's done by teachers' colleges in coordination with the state accrediting agency. And I think that's something that Claudio and I have seen quite a bit, is that accrediting standards across the country are still different. They're viewed differently. They change all the time. It's very hard for the federal government to have an influence on that process.
Claudio, talk a little bit about the teachers' colleges. Are some of these reform efforts actually aimed at them?
Certainly. And there is evidence out there that, for good reason. There are roughly, last time I checked, 1,300 colleges and universities in this country that are offering teaching degrees. I've had people tell me that no more than 50 are really doing a good job, and that's astounding to me. In the time I've spent with some teachers' colleges for this series, it's clear that the pressure on them is enormous, and the pressure is not just coming from the outside. It's coming from the inside as well. The National Council for Accrediting Teachers' Colleges, for example, says that it now is going to require these programs to prove that they're relevant. And again, for us to be talking about, you know, making the education or the training of teachers relevant to the real world is amazing, because so many teachers, the bulk of teachers these days, are in schools where they're really not being well prepared.
Larry, how about efforts to attract people from outside the teaching profession to go into teaching? How's that working out?
Well, this is actually an area of great hope, I think, that people see that this isn't a profession that you necessarily need to join right in college, that some of the most promising teachers are people who have switched careers. You see in all of these privately run nonprofits like the New Teacher Project, the Boston Teacher Residency, Chicago Teaching Fellows, which Secretary of Education Arne Duncan was deeply involved in, that they are actually, even though they're relatively small compared to the 4 million teachers that are around this country, they actually are pushing revolutionary change that is kind of infecting the teachers' colleges that we're talking about. And a lot of these teacher colleges are actually taking their direction from some of these residency programs. And there's a great deal of hope seen, I think, in those areas.
Larry, you mentioned pay for teachers' compensation being tied to performance. Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, it's happening, but I have to say it's happening really slowly, and it's happening on the margins. The kinds of incentives that we're seeing are important, and there are a radical change in teacher contracts, which were mostly based on seniority, but they still don't really impact the bulk of teacher compensation. I think it's going to be a long time before we see really meaningful change in that area.
And Leanne, if I may add, it's not just the concept of pay for performance. It's really the evaluation process. What goes into determining what a good teacher is doing and how they're doing it?
Look forward to your series of reports over the next year. NPR's education correspondents, Claudio Sanchez and Larry Abramson, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Miners have hearty appetites. They work hard during the cold Michigan mornings. So when the whistle blows for lunch, it's time for a pasty. That's a turnover filled with meat, potatoes, onions, and spices. It was brought here by immigrant miners from Cornwall, England.
Are you Peter?
I am.
I'm Leanne Hansen from NPR.
Hi, Leanne.
Peter
it's
Laurie.
A pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. What time did you come to work today?
We were here about 5:30 or so.
We visited Laurie's pasty shop in Marquette. Peter
yes.
Laurie runs the three-generation family business that's been in this area since 1946.
Hi.
His ancestors worked the mines around the turn of the century.
Hi there.
You're Mike?
I'm Mike,
and
yep.
you own the original shop?
The original, yep.
Mike is Peter's younger brother. He's usually at his own shop farther down U.S. 41. His grandmother opened it near the mines of Ishpeming.
We'll have a taste test now. You can tell us who wins.
You always yeah. compete like this, you two?
Pretty much. We're only 13 months apart, so we grew up wrestling and throwing each other over furniture. My brother and my sister and I started making pasties in about third grade in the summer times with our grandma. we'd have to go in the cooler and dip the potatoes out of a big bucket because it was cold and nobody wanted to do it, so we'd go get the potatoes, and that's how we learned how. And then when we made our first couple pasties, we'd go spend the night at Grandma's house and eat our pasties and show our grandpa, you know, how we did.
Meat, onions, potatoes, and rutabaga are mixed in a tub. Peter shakes in spices. The mixture is scooped into the dough. This is called gobbing. Mike folds the crust over the stuffing, then shows off his special technique to seal it up.
I like to, when I'm teaching people, say it's kind of like a wave where you roll the top over the bottom. It's like a wave rolling in on shore.
So, and now it looks like a turnover with a bit of a wavy braid on top.
Outside. Yeah. Yep. That's the part that people like to break off and dip in ketchup.
Smell that.
Isn't that wonderful?
Beef.
There's
and
no other
pie
smell.
Crust.
Although I'll tell you, it's wonderful in the morning when you're hungry, when you go home in the afternoon and your wife says, oh, you smell like a pasty again? Then it's a little different.
Funny, sometimes when we go to the bank with our deposits in the morning, the ladies in there will tell us that our money smells like pasties and it makes them hungry.
We're having some pasties after the show, and you can find a recipe from Peter and Mike Laurie on our website, npr.org. This is NPR News.
After 3,600 stories and countless hours of reading, here's the moment we've all been waiting for. It's time to announce the winner of round two of our 3-minute fiction contest. Now, I'm going to need some help with that, so let's bring in James Wood. James, are you there?
I am.
James Wood, of course, is the New Yorker's literary critic and our guide this round to 3-minute fiction. James, we asked listeners to send in original short stories that can be read in 3 minutes or less, hence the name 3-minute fiction. But we made this round a bit more challenging by assigning a first line, which was?
The line was, the nurse left work at 5 o'clock.
Okay, what did our listeners do with that first line, James?
They did amazing things. The standard story, which I hadn't expected at all, seemed to involve a nurse walking home, immediately lighting up a cigarette, and then as soon as she gets home, dissolving into alcoholism. An interesting number of stories twisted it round so that it wasn't the perspective of the nurse, it was from the perspective of the patient as the nurse leaves the room, which was a nice thing to do. And some wonderful stories, a good number, dispensed entirely with that kind of ordinariness, predictability, whatever, and just played wonderful games and arabesques with this idea. I have a few examples if you'd like to
hear them.
Yeah, please,
absolutely.
Two terrific stories that were in tight contention with the eventual winner. Lisa Saracen's story, Poetry at Six, is set in a creative writing class, and someone is actually speaking that first line and then doing an analysis of why it's a good line of poetry, just sort of scanning it for meter. And Will Dowd's story, The First Session, is about a nurse leaving work and going to a marriage counseling session only to find that her husband, a quantum physicist, has been exhibiting what is called quantum behavior. It's very funny. They're both extremely funny stories.
And we'll be posting those online as well with the winning story. All right, James, we've been waiting long enough. Reveal our winner for us, please.
The winner is Kathy Formusa, and we have here a terrific story, and I would love to read it out.
So this story that you're about to read is called Last Scene. It's by Kathy Formusa from Port Townsend, Washington. James, the story, please.
The nurse left work at 5 o'clock. He sauntered his words at me like he was king of the street. How do you know, Pablo? Maybe you went cold. Had a flash, you know, blacked out. And when you woke up, you thought it was 5. I was pushing him now, just to see how sure he was. I like her. He lowered his head humbly for a moment, then abruptly continued in a strength I hadn't ever seen or felt from him before. "She brings me coffee sometimes at 5 o'clock. It was 5 o'clock when my angel in white brought me coffee. And she smiles at me, my coffee angel. No Starbucco never done that for me, but my angel does at 5 o'clock. She left at 5, and I saw her." Pablo karate chopped his right hand, slicing the air between us to make his point. He smelt so ripe in the afternoon's August heat, I let it go. I handed him a few bucks and continued my search for her killer.
Wow, what a story. James, Kathy Formusa has been listening online from her hometown of Port Townsend, Washington. Kathy Formusa, congratulations and welcome.
I'm absolutely honored. Thank you.
Congratulations, Kathy.
Thank you so very much. Do I get to call myself a writer now?
I think you decidedly do. In fact, one of the questions I would have is whether you've been writing regularly up to this moment.
No, I've always had this novel in my head, and I started writing it about a year ago, and I had left my main character in the Amazon, and she's actually on a shaman's drug trip right now, and I think that's why I took a break and wrote your story.
Kathy, what do you do out there in Port Townsend?
Coming up, 2010 will be my 20th year as a massage therapist.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, I love it.
We clocked your story at 50 seconds, so you could probably inaugurate our one-minute fiction contest. You had 2 minutes, 10 seconds to work with. You won with a 50-second story. James Wood, what distinguished Kathy's story from the other finalists?
Well, you put your finger on it. First of all, brevity. In both this contest and the last one, I was looking for something that absolutely pushed the form as tightly as possible, most approximated to poetry, to some mysterious snatched anecdote. And this has it. It doesn't start the way you expect it to. It doesn't proceed the way you expect it to. It doesn't end the way you expect it to. And I like particularly this possibility that the entirety of it is illusion, you know, that he's just having a trip or, you know, he's just making it up and is wasting the detective's time.
Pretty high praise, Kathy, from
James Wood. Wow, it's so nice to write something and not only to have it read the way that I had the voices in my head and the characters, but also to hear that those comments, they feel so good because I wondered if I really got that across to anybody.
Kathy, how did you sort of come up with the conceit behind the story?
Well, I thought it was so descriptive. The nurse left work at 5 o'clock. Boy, boom, an image. And then I thought, who saw her? And then I saw this character, this street man, and then I fell in love with him, and then I decided to bring in a detective.
Do you have any formal training as a writer? Did you ever take any writing workshops or anything like that?
Nope, just Mrs. Johnson in junior high saying, that's good, Kathy, keep going. Thank you very much.
Now, you are, Kathy, you are actually talking to us from your boyfriend's home sound studio in Port Townsend, because you are way out on the Olympic Peninsula, about an hour and a half from Seattle, right?
Yes. We can wave to Victoria, Canada, like Sarah Palin can wave to Russia.
I heard that your boyfriend Gary has made waffles for the entire town of Port Townsend every Sunday since 1969.
It was his grandmother's tradition, and he kept it up. And every Sunday morning, he opens up his house to whoever drops in. And there are a lot of characters in our town, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
yes? I can hear a story coming on already.
Oh, my goodness. Every person in this town is a story.
I also heard a rumor that you once gave a massage to the former poet laureate, Billy Collins, after he came in for those Sunday waffles. Is that true?
Oh, he came to visit our town for Port Townsend Film Festival, and his back went out, so I helped him out.
And you gave him a massage?
I did.
James, you have any plans for next Sunday morning?
Well, now you say it, my back is a little bit sore.
We use real maple syrup and real whipped cream.
Oh, not for the massage, though. Just for the waffles.
Oh, the massage. We'll talk.
That's Kathy Formusa, whose short story, Last Scene, is the winner of round two of our three-minute fiction contest. You can read Kathy's story as well as those of the runners-up and other contenders at our series page. It's www.npr.org/3-minute-fiction with 3-minute fiction all spelled out. Kathy, thanks so much and good luck to you.
Thank you so much. And James, I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Thank you very much.
And as Kathy mentioned, she will receive a signed copy of James Wood's book, How Fiction Works. James is the New Yorker's literary critic. He teaches at Harvard, and he's the judge of the first two rounds of 3 Minute Fiction. James, thanks so much for your help.
Pleasure.
We're going to take a break from 3 Minute Fiction for just a short while, but we will be back with new challenges, new judges, and, of course, new stories from you.
Marquette, Michigan is a place you have to experience at least twice. This trip, I packed fleece and tried to bring a jar of thimbleberry jelly back home. I needed sunblock, and my jelly was confiscated at the airport because it was more than 3 ounces. Mistake. Daytime temperatures in downtown Marquette were near record highs, low 80s, no wind, calm lake. Youpers were flocking to the shores of Lake Superior. The summer had been colder than normal, so as the days began to get shorter, it was beach week in Marquette. I got a sunburn. The last time I came to town, it was winter and wicked cold. Brisk gusts of wind slapped my face on the way down to the shore. The cafe patios were closed. The massive iron ore rail troughs stood silent guard over the harbor, and cross-country skis replaced bicycles on the paths hugging the shoreline. Longtime residents advised me, if you want to live in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, get an outside hobby. I like skating. One thing has put Marquette on the map, speed skating. Our visit coincided with the Olympic trials for short track, and the stars were out. Apollo Ono made the team, but came in second during our time there. The competition was held at the Berry Events Center, a venue which holds more than 4,000 spectators for skating, hockey, basketball, and concerts. Before the action began on the ice, this community wanted to welcome all the visitors. The theater department of Northern Michigan University was commissioned to put on a show. On a balcony overlooking the skating oval, earnest performers in shades of red, black, and white presented a pageant of the American experience in the Upper Peninsula. Playwright and composer Shelley Russell kindly sent a studio recording.
Nothing but bare rock, gray sky, like I never left Scotland.
It's cold here, brother.
Not a field here, Joe. Not a bloody thing but trees. Nothing but rocks and trees.
This place is not civilized.
Imagine then Finnish, British, Italian, Chinese families arriving in this stone-cold place, making use of the natural resources to stake a claim in America.
I thought when I got here, I'd feel I'd gotten somewhere, but all I feel is far away from home. I thought when I got here, the rest behind me.
Papa, can we please go home?
The people who call this place home now are no-nonsense, hardworking, humorous, welcoming, but wary. Youpers want you to know how lucky they are to live in such a beautiful place and how hard it is to do that. How their jokes about themselves are funnier than anything you've heard and why you shouldn't move there. Just visit. Anytime. Come again. And next time, ship the thimbleberry jelly home. You can see pictures and more from Michigan on our website, npr.org. Our field producers for these stories from the Upper Peninsula were Kimberly Adams and Ned Wharton. Special thanks to Brent Bachman for his help with research. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News, directed by Elaine Heinzman and produced by Walter Ray Watson, Sarah Beyer Kelly, Thomas Pierce, Charla Bear, Veronica Miller, Theo Balcom, and Carolyn Beeler, with assistance from our interns Sarah Molnar and Annika Robbins. Our technical director is Burke Hahn, ably assisted by Ted Mebane and Neil Tivolt. Our reference librarian is Key Molesky. Melissa Goh is our web producer. Our show was edited this week by Cindy Johnston and produced by Ned Wharton. The senior producer of Weekend Edition is Devar Iran Ardalan. I'm Leanne Hansen.